Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Good morning to you, Nachum.
This is a, well, you'll tell us to what degree this is scary. I know that it certainly dominated everyone's thoughts yesterday, those who follow the news, especially here in the New York and New Jersey area. Two Americans of North African descent, one of whom complained that the world was treating Muslims like dogs, bought guns and a grenade and wanted to carry out a terror plot against a New York shul. Now, I'm reading from the front page of Hamodia, the AP story they have as the headline. Now, these two guys were arrested. The mayor of the city of New York, plus the police commissioner, plus the DA of Manhattan, all participated in this news conference yesterday. Malcolm, what is your reaction to this local but really international story?
Well, I think there are several important messages here. One, that the killing of Osama bin Laden was not the end of the war on terror, that people not become complacent because of the elimination of one person. Second, that we see the tendency to move towards the independent operatives, even though we often find out that they, in fact, had some contact with somebody, that there was somebody who either trained them or did something with them in the course of either a police prisoner contact or training abroad or something, or some inspiration by a radical clergyman. I mean, there are a lot of different potential sources where people get this kind of incitement. It's not usually just something that they make up out of their own heads. I think also the warning that we have given people perhaps 1,000 times, that we are moving in this direction and that people have to take security seriously. The guy said we're going to dress up like religious Jews and go into a synagogue.
Right.
We have no screening in our synagogues as you have in Europe and you have elsewhere. And generally, not even an awareness of it. And people would not even be suspect. And I'm not saying that because a stranger comes, you know, you harass him. But if people would, you know, take advantage of all the information available and all of the resources that we put up through SCAN, scnus.org, SCN, Secure Community Network, US.org, they would, and we put yesterday morning at 6:30, we had out a thing called an active shooters, which is what this is. You know, when you have somebody with a gun, gets a gun, goes into a populated situation,
right.
Well, how people can prepare. And you'd be surprised that if, God forbid, a situation arises, these things come back to you about what you saw in this video.
But, you know, Malcolm, I mean, look, I haven't spent much time in Europe, but, you know, in Israel, it's not like every synagogue has screening systems. And you know, every place you walk, I'm sure in Europe it's the same way. It's not like every single one. Maybe the large ones or the, you know, high-profile ones do. But, I mean, it's rare that, you know, that there's security systems in place everywhere.
No, in Great Britain, in every synagogue.
What does that mean? If there's a big Jewish neighborhood and there's, you know, two synagogues per block, every one of them has some type of security system?
Well, I haven't visited every synagogue.
No, I know.
I'm being serious. Every synagogue I have visited has it, and it's through an amazing organization they have, the CST, Community Security Trust, which spends millions and millions of dollars on, I don't know, I think there are 300 shuls in England, certainly 300,000 people compared to 6 million. So it's not feasible here to replicate what they've done in Europe, and I don't think it's necessarily the imperative to go to that extent.
Right.
But what I'm talking about is awareness. I'm talking about fundamental steps that people can take. The one, the simplest thing, which is not a total situation solution or even maybe the first step, but a camera hanging near a door that people can get a picture of somebody who is monitoring the synagogue, who watches it. And now, look, these guys didn't pick a target, and they had been watched by the police, as was the case with the Riverdale trio that also wanted to blow up a synagogue. But I think it's the warning, and the fact that we're getting advanced warning is what we should take advantage of.
Right. You know, some people expressed to me the shock of how young these guys were, but then I said, but, you know, how many teenagers worldwide are ready to give their life to, you know, to kill Jews and Americans? So, I mean, the age they were in their low to mid-20s was not a surprise at all, right?
Well, how many times do we have teenagers here, Columbine type attacks,
right,
throughout the United States? Age is not a factor at all.
I guess when it comes to leadership in this area, you know, if you're looking for those who are, you'd think they'd be, you know, a little bit older. But these guys, as you say, weren't really following anybody, so to speak. There wasn't.
But I think that if we trace down, do they belong to a mosque? One came from Algeria, one from Morocco.
Right.
One had American citizenship, one didn't. But you multiply this by the number of potential people holding similar views, and you realize the nature of the threat. And I keep saying that people don't know how many cases are actually caught in the United States each year.
Right.
They don't even get any notice when they're convicted. I mean, it's part of the problem is that people don't get the information and certainly don't take it seriously.
I'll move on from this in a minute, but I just, you know, sometimes you have to sit back and think, and I know there have been plenty of episodes, and I know, and obviously 9/11 and you know, other things that don't always go right. But it seems like in this area, the NYPD, FBI, whoever's responsible for, you know, for quelling all these things, it seems like there's been a lot of luck. You know what I mean? I mean, I know sometimes you make your own breaks, and, you know, the research and the diligence obviously helps. But we haven't gotten to the point where we've suffered a random attack, certainly not in the last 10 years, that has really shaken the city.
It is true, and I think the NYPD is way ahead of the rest of the country, sometimes even ahead of the federal agencies, to the credit of Commissioner Kelly and others at the NYPD, that they have done a great deal. New York invests an immense amount of money in this, but we are a primary target, although if you listen to what Osama bin Laden supposedly was saying, he was telling them to go to smaller cities because there the level of awareness,
right,
and perhaps the sophistication is less. So New York is unique in that regard, but if you notice, the FBI was not part of this operation.
Right, right. I saw that.
And so right away, this speculation was that it was because of the tensions and they didn't inform him. And it turns out that they said, look, this is not the kind of operation you need us. And it was handled very well locally.
Right. When we see the words Al-Qaeda and Taliban, are they synonymous or not? Because, no. Say it again?
No, they are not.
Because today in the, and I have to bring it up just to see it here, the killings, the 69 people who were killed in the explosions in Pakistan. So it says it's the Pakistani Taliban for, you know, taking their first revenge for the killing of Osama bin Laden. So is he an Al-Qaeda guy? Is he a Taliban guy? Is he a crossover guy? I mean, you know.
Well, in Afghanistan, Taliban and Al-Qaeda are closely linked. In outside of Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda exists in many other countries where they are not Taliban, just extremist Muslim radical murderers. And
all right, so it's not unusual for someone who wants to take revenge for the bin Laden killing to call themselves
No, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, it would be the linkage is very close to them. Just as in other countries, from China to Morocco, they are. You have Al Qaeda of North Africa, for instance, which is unique, and they're not all run from one central operation, but they all link together.
Right. And why does this terror? And again, you know, why does this terror group target Northwest Pakistan? Why are they not going after what are more noticeably Western targets if they're trying to avenge the killing of bin Laden?
Well, here, because of what they allege is the cooperation of the government, and it's really a dual target. Look who they went after. They went after military recruits. They killed 80 of them,
right,
or more. And that's a high profile for them, but it's also because they're eliminating those who are fighting them.
So it's And when they, and like you always say, pay careful attention to what the enemy says. So if they're making threats now to continue to avenge his killing, again, we have to be more on guard than ever.
Absolutely.
I saw this morning about the threat of an Intifada 3, and I said to myself, you know, that with the atmosphere that was created over the last few months in the Middle East, in a way, it's shocking that there hasn't been an uprising or a quote-unquote Intifada 3. And I'm wondering, is it the prospect of the a declaration of a Palestinian state, unilateral declaration of a Palestinian state, is that what's keeping Palestinian leadership from, and I assume it is leadership that calls for the Intifada, is it they who, because of that reason, and they don't want to take that off the table, go ahead and they don't encourage the folks in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza to cause a third Intifada?
Okay, yes, a lot of questions. So, number one, it's not generally leadership that has called the events in the Middle East these days. Second, a lot of the events that happened was because of economic unrest and because of the crackdown on, you know, the rise of price of food and the subsidies being removed, et cetera, and the political situation also dictated. Those things do not obtain in the territories today. In West Bank, the economic situation has improved dramatically. I think that the September unilateral declaration could become the occasion for some big demonstrations, and the Nakba Day, what they call the disaster day, we could see some serious manifestations. There are talks about marches throughout the West Bank, and we'll have to see what happens within Israel as well. So there's the troops, the IDF is on high alert for it. They've been training them in special crowd control mechanisms. The Palestinians were making light of it, saying that this is not, you know, anything that warrants that kind of response. And until now, the leadership has spoken against it and has worked against any kind of public manifestations, large scale. But I think it is not beyond expectation that at some point you could have. And what if you had 100,000 people, 200,000 people, which you can get easily, started to march or demonstrate? It's a nightmare scenario that has been discussed many times in many places.
I understand the practical difference in terms of how these revolutions started and, you know, hit the streets in other countries, but wouldn't you say in both intifadas that it wasn't...
Well, they learned a lesson. The intifada cost them more than it cost Israel, which takes a heavy toll, tourism for Israel and
economic areas. Right, so then you're making my point. Isn't it, in fact, the leadership of the PA or...
Well, the people know. The people pay the price on this. As I said, you know, the leadership has worked and spoken against an intifada, although they hold this threat over Israel all the time. And, you know, if you talk about it enough, at one point it really happens.
All right, to boil my question down to this, is the fact that they want to declare a Palestinian state in the next few months irrelevant in terms of whether they're going to have an intifada or not?
No, I think if it, as I said, I think it can become the occasion for...
No, that's if they do declare. I'm saying the prospect of not wanting to ruin the prospect of declaring. Is that what's keeping the intifada down?
Oh, that's an interesting theory. I have not seen that expressed in any way, because the people who would call for it, I mean, remember, you have no real Hamas infrastructure. You don't have the kind of potential, and the Fatah groups have too much to gain and too much to lose, too much to gain from stability, too much to lose from instability. So I don't think that the prospect is what's holding back those who support the unilateral declaration. I think for us, it's a much bigger issue than it is for many of the people who live in the territories.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program. Heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Let's assume that we agree. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you'll have a chance to respond in a minute. Let's assume we agree that if there's somebody with questionable comments regarding Israel, we have a right to express our dissent when it comes to honoring that individual. I'm talking about, obviously, the Tony Kushner situation. So let's assume that that's legitimate. And then, of course, the body has the body of people that are responsible for bestowing these awards obviously have a right to proceed as they wish based on their policies, I guess. So how does one... If it's legitimate to express dissent for decisions about honoring certain people because of the views of Israel, how does one do so and not cause backlash, which might make one regret that they started the thing to begin with?
All right, let's...
Or is there a responsible way to go ahead and express dissent honoring somebody whose views on Israel are questionable?
So many options. Look, I think, first of all, that there's been a lot of distortion about what Kushner has said. It's one thing if you criticize Israeli policies. It's another thing when you accuse Israel of ethnic cleansing or challenge Israel's right to exist, something he denies he did, and some of it has come from websites. But certainly, I don't know in comparable situations regarding other citizens who have an affinity to a land that you would have this kind of criticism or these kind of comments, that they would nominate him for an award, even though they say the award is about his artistic work and nothing to do with his attitudes towards Israel. One can discuss, as you said, whether you go public, you don't go public, how you handle it, but I think that what the trustee, Jeff Wiesenfeld, who deserves all the credit because he raised a legitimate issue, he didn't even intend that it be defeated, he raised it to get his personal to create a statement
right.
So that the people know exactly who they're voting for, and it turned out that others found it convincing enough that they voted against it, though none of them were willing to speak up later, and I think he was subjected to really terrible vilification, which would not have happened if it had been somebody who had from South Africa or something else who had been criticized for some statements and positions they took. And and in the end, Kushner is getting the award. This is about Tony Kushner, the playwright.
Right.
He's getting the award despite the controversy. But I think the record was established. Whether this sets us back, because in the future people will be reluctant to speak up. And then there were people who criticized and have since reversed their position, some very prominent individuals, who recognized that the seriousness of what was said, and I think that calling for his resignation is outrageous because of his simply expressing a point of view, and then you have the union, which claims to speak for the faculty, and I hope that faculty members who are listening will publicly say they don't speak for me, and the calls for and they join in with vicious signs outside the board meeting and calling for Wiesenfeld's removal. They can't remove him. He has till 2013. Legally, and hopefully he'll serve it out.
All right, so essentially you had no problem with the whole process. The way the media reported it and vilified him is what disturbed you.
No, I mean, there are a lot of questions, but you, it's easy to sit in judgment when I think what he did initially was not an irresponsible act. He
right.
was simply putting on the record things about Kushner. You can debate, people have debated some of the assertions, but that's, a legitimate issue. But the record that this guy is lying about the things that he has said in the past, or appears to be, has been charged by many people that show past statements. And now he asserts that he's a great supporter of Israel, and maybe that's an accomplishment.
There you go. Maybe he'll have some influence on people that way. Does it bother you when Erdogan of Turkey says that Hamas is not a terror organization, or is that just par for the course?
No, it isn't. It's very disturbing, and Turkey right now is facing a lot of challenges because of the situation in Syria. We see how they have abandoned the Sunni populations, whether in Lebanon or Syria or other places where they sided with the regimes that were working against the Sunni population that they claim to be the advocates for, the defenders of. I think the situation in Turkey remains very troubling. They are working with Iran. They continue to be in that orbit. We've seen that another flotilla with Turkey's backing.
Why was that delayed, by the way?
Because of the elections in Turkey.
Oh.
So they didn't want to have this as a diversion, so the likelihood is...
And what is it? It's state-sponsored? Because I know it's an organization that does it.
It's
but
an organization,
but you
the
can't
government
do...
clearly gives it backing. And they didn't want this to be a diversion internally in Turkey, because you never know what the outcome could have been.
So a month from now, we may be having the same type of episode again.
We right now it's on schedule for about 5 weeks from now,
right.
With the IHH, which is designated a terrorist organization, and working with what they call the Free Gaza Movement.
What's Israel going to do?
And Israel will have to take stands. It has to act. And many members of the House and Senate wrote to Erdogan, the Prime Minister of Turkey, and said that they have to stop this. That these claims that they're independent groups and that he has no control over it. When he wants to have control, he has control. And I think it's really important that these markers were put down. We have, and others have relayed messages about it. But, they find themselves in a sort of strange position given their relationship with Assad and with Turkey, with Iran.
You think there'll be arms on that flotilla?
Do I think there will be arms on the flotilla? There well could be. But we should be clear, for those who still raise the argument with me about this being a humanitarian thing,
right.
And why do we interfere, it's not humanitarian. If they want to send aid, there are plenty of ways you can send aid directly over land. They could send it to Egypt. They could send it through Ashdod, and it will be all delivered. And the aid that was on those boats was all medicines that were long outdated. None of it could be used. This is a propaganda campaign. This is a way to break Israel's right to defend itself and to defend against weapons and other things, contraband coming to Gaza. There is no need in Gaza. Even the UN report shows that there is an abundance of food and things in Gaza.
The President of the United States is scheduled to address the Arab nations again, as he did a couple of years back?
Well, he's scheduled to give an address in which I understand that he will address the Muslim/Arab world, talk about the Arab Spring, talk about the murder of Osama bin Laden, give a vision, urge them to reject extremism and extreme Islam, say it's a new opportunity to build relations, doing this outreach.
When's this going to happen?
Within the next few days.
And what do you think? Is it a waste of time?
Well, we'll have to see the reaction. I think that the first speeches didn't have the desired effect or impact. but now the United States is frankly in a rather isolated position in most countries and has been marginalized to a large degree in the events of the Arab Spring. So I think his attempt to reassert it, again, I don't know what the words will say,
right.
But one has to think about the audience you're addressing, not about our interpretation of it, but their interpretation of it. And I think there really has to be a message of strength. There has to be a message saying you have to reject it, you have to act against extremism, that we will work, that Osama bin Laden doesn't end our efforts, that we continue the war on terrorism, that we stand with our allies, we stand with our friends, and that we want to help move the region. We're prepared to do our part to help move the region towards real democracy. But if one looks at what's happened in the region, you see what the statements in Egypt, what's happening in other parts of it. Tunisia is a stalemate. Algeria, we have big demonstrations still. Libya, the fighting goes on. Egypt, shifting every day back and forth, but more and more radical positions being emerging.
Syria.
Lebanon, stalemated. Bahrain, somewhat at a stalemate with the announcing that the troops are going to stay there long after and forever and whatever goes on. And of course, you know, the deaths in Syria, the crackdown. If you take each of the situations, none of them so far can be seen as models for democracy. Quite the opposite. We're quite uncertain, and we see the Islamic Brotherhoods in a lot of the countries becoming more and more visible. In Egypt, you know, calling for an end to Israel ties and announcing that they're going to campaign in half the seats, not a quarter of the seats. You see the president, presidential candidate, who's the leading candidate, hitting Israel every day on the nuclear issues, on other issues, talking about reassessing their relationship. Not very positive signs that, and at the same time, that the Christians there, the COPS, COPTS, and the Muslim Brotherhood says openly, we think that they were too powerful under Mubarak, that he didn't control them. They're about 10% of the population, and they want to, quote, teach him a lesson right now, and that they want him to know that they're dependent on the protection of Muslims. I mean, it's, again, the dhimmi status for Christians in Egypt, and you hardly hear, where is the criticism? Where are the people talking about the 13 Christians who were killed a week ago or so? Where's the outcry? It's just amazing. The same thing in Iran, where they've been executing people, including a Jewish woman, in the last days. The reports of a Jewish woman.
The Christian population of Egypt is just 10%?
It's about, yeah, there. But that's 8 million people.
I didn't realize it was that low, though, in percentage.
Well, their life has been pretty tough there.
Earlier in the week, the Yom HaZikaron Israel Memorial Day commemoration, Yom HaAtzmaut Israel Independence Day celebration at the opening ceremony of the Independence Day. So we saw the action taken by Gilad Shalit's brother in protest. Obviously, a terrible scene for everybody, because no winners in that one. Let's put it that way. I bring it up because someone mentioned to me that we know that the Shalits are spending the majority of their time right near the prime minister's residence in a structure that's now their tent, their place, in protest of the Israeli government. Should the family be spending more time in other countries? Should they be appealing to governments outside of the Israeli government for their son's release?
Well, they have, and they are in constant contact with foreign governments, and when the visitors come to Israel, they often meet with the Shalits, as do we. They have traveled here. They've traveled to Europe. You don't read about it necessarily all the time when they're going. And, you know, this is supported by the government of Israel. So while they can protest, and one understands the frustrations of the family, nobody has yet shown where what the government of Israel could have done. I mean, the offers have been very generous, and we see that Hamas leaders keep playing this card, hinting that there are negotiations, then denying there are negotiations. We also have to remember that Hamas has a varied leadership. It's not that as if there's just one person. You have Haniya and then Mashal, who operates out of Damascus, Ahmad Jaberi, Mohammed Deif. You have others who, you know, each play and knock the other one because they're looking for future leadership positions. So I think what the boy did was not appropriate on the occasion, but we know the frustration, and maybe because it brings the attention of the world, that is a benefit to get people to understand the pain that a family feels. Nobody can second-guess this. And we know families who have now waited 25 years, 30 years for an answer. Parents die not knowing, and the existence is torturous.
No question about that. Prime Minister still scheduled to visit Washington?
He is scheduled to come next Friday, meeting the president, and then we'll address a joint session on the 24th, and we'll have meetings with congressional leaders, AIPAC, others, so he will have a good schedule.
So he'll be spending Lag BaOmer in the United States.
I'm sure he'll be out with his bow and arrow.
I would assume so. What do you think of the Demyanyuk conviction?
Listen, it doesn't give you much comfort that he got 5 years, but it gives you comfort to the message to the other Demyanyuks out there that they can never take for granted that they have beaten the rap, that evil ultimately is confronted, and whether it's in this world or the next, but they will be held to account, and that I think that it does justice for all those who rushed his defense, the Pat Buchanans of the world who, you know, always advocate, oh, that he's an innocent guy, it was a mistaken identity, whatever the documents the judge has seen. This has been a prolonged process. He certainly was given much more justice than he ever gave any one of the victims, and that he has the right to appeal is going to keep him out of jail for now. But I hope that he gets to jail and suffers for the rest of his life.
Is there any reaction, maybe even reaction that I just simply don't see, but is there any reaction to this Hamas PA peace initiative of their own, their new unity agreement? Because it seems like nobody's saying much about it, and certainly nobody's criticizing, at least I don't see anybody criticizing the PA for joining in with this outward terror organization.
Well, let me answer that in various parts. First, there is a great deal of attention and reaction being paid. I've seen the administration statements, which have been a little bit wobbling, moving back and forth again on the issue, but clearly now saying that they can't deal with as long as Hamas is there. You've had the majority of members of the House and Senate have written various letters, resolutions, saying that they will not allow aid to go. As you know, Hamas is designated by the State Department as a foreign terrorist organization. It's designated by the Treasury Department as well, so you can't do business with them. You can't trade if Hamas is there. Abbas, by the way, announced that they should look for another candidate for president because he doesn't want to get caught in the race. We don't know if that's true. They're also fighting over Fayyad. But I think the law of in the United States will require us not to help them and to cut off at least the remaining assistance. There's very little left for this year, but it's important in terms of any allocation for next year. Now, we should remember that Hamas is going to issue statements, so people not get excited when you see something where they say we're going to act in concert with the Fatah, we're not going to make decisions, that the ceasefire will continue because it's in our interest. They're going to do whatever they think serves their purposes. And we've seen the first rally of Hamas in Ramallah over the past few days. Hundreds of Hamas members and supporters were able to go public, something they couldn't do, and they held a Hamas flag publicly. While in Gaza itself, the Hamas broke up an al-Qaeda gathering in support of Osama bin Laden. So they're not very tolerant. They also said they will not let Abbas come and visit Gaza, that they will not allow Fatah to open an office in Gaza. They won't let their security forces in Gaza. So this is really one heck of a marriage. Not even through the honeymoon.
Yeah, but I can't believe that either.
What?
Okay, on paper they're not working together, but they are.
Well, first of all, they've worked together in the past in certain ways, and money was going from the Palestinian Authority to pay all these guys in Gaza all along. This is not a ploy, as some people said. Hamas continues to say they will never recognize Israel, and that they continue with the same positions. The Italians, by the way, came out very strong this week against a unilateral declaration. The Europeans and the French and the British even issued statements about the conditions for them to be able to deal with Hamas, because they signed Oslo II, which requires that that they accept Israel's right to exist, disband the terrorism operations, etc. Germany warned against the unilateral declaration and expressed concern about the Hamas Fatah thing. So it's not that it's not being discussed. And there are a lot of tensions between them that are still playing out. So we'll see how long it lasts. For now, it's got to be shown that this is what the true nature of what Israel is facing, and that any attempt to try and demand Israel now to negotiate with Hamas is a non-starter.
Netanyahu has an opportunity to express all this in his speech to the joint session.
I fully expect that he will.
I don't know if he'll be as strong as I want him to be.
The next time I think we'll get you to give this.
No, but I'm being serious. He has an opportunity to lay it out there and essentially say Israel has no interest in participating in negotiations with an entity like this, and I don't think he'll do that.
I do think he'll do that. I think that he'll be falling very short if he doesn't say it, but he has to say what he will say is, that he was prepared to come here and be forthcoming and offer stuff, but now that this new situation has arisen, said we can't sit down and negotiate any more than you would want us, that you would have negotiated with Osama bin Laden. We wouldn't do it. Israel shouldn't be asked to do it. And I think he will talk about what the Arab Spring means, that he can talk about the situation in Syria. You saw the interviews this week in the New York Times, which I thought were very telling, because in one of them, Rami Makhlouf, the businessman, billionaire, cousin of Assad, says, well, if it's trouble for Syria, it'll be trouble for Israel.
Right.
And that was not merely a threat. What he was saying is that if we collapse, the quiet border will go, and that it will pose dangers to Israel, and Iran could be, and Hezbollah could go wild. I mean, there are a lot of concerns about.
And that's in addition to worrying about inside the borders.
Pardon me?
That's in addition to worrying about inside the border.
That's exactly right. And the Hezbollah, there are reports that they are moving their assets from Syria because they're, second guessing whether Assad can really last. And supposedly there's a town, Adra, which is northeast of Damascus, where they put their. They have fighters, have living quarters, Hezbollah fighters or terrorists, and they also have fleets of trucks and arms, and which the arms they get over land by plane, but they store it there. There's also a lot of concern as to what happens with these weapons, especially the missiles and the chemical weapons, weapons of mass destruction that Syria has, if there's a collapse of the regime. What is important also in this context, and I think Iran will be a primary issue for the prime minister in his remarks, it has to be, is to look at what's happening inside this fight that I think I mentioned over the last couple of weeks between Khamenei and Ahmadinejad seems to be escalating. And you have representatives of the Palestinians, Lebanese, Yemenis, Bahraini, Iraqi groups are said to be training all the time in Iran. We also know, by the way, that the revelations this week about, again, something we've talked about for a long time, how in Venezuela they have a training camp, an Iranian training camp for people from various Arab countries like Saudis and Bahrainis and Kuwaitis. It's a private training camp in Wahira, which is a very remote area, and they're training them in bombs and other things. One of the instructions was that if Iran gets attacked, that they should blow up the embassies of Gulf countries, Egypt, Morocco, and others, let alone going after other targets. And it talks about how they finance this through Iranian drug dealings and connections to the cartel. But just to go back for one second, the split is very real. It's being manifested in more and more ways. And we see it now through the Iran Revolutionary Guard, where you have some who are affiliated and have an affinity towards Ahmadinejad, who comes from there, but also the supreme leader, who is now giving instructions to them and to coordinate their efforts with the Basiji, who are these extremist militants. There's supposedly a thing called the Building Plan 55, which some opposition groups have revealed, where they talk about steps that they have to take, how to work out of the mosques, and trying to isolate the supporters of Ahmadinejad. So I think this split is something I hope that the appropriate people are all looking at to take advantage.
Haven't we learned that the religious leader usually wins in these splits?
The supreme leader will win in this, but you know Ahmadinejad has established a pretty strong network. This all broke out over the firing by Ahmadinejad of the Minister of Intelligence, because it turns out that he was bugging maybe Ahmadinejad, but also his chief of staff's office. The Khamenei did not like his chief of staff. It became a fight. He fired Ahmadinejad, fired the minister, and Khamenei reappointed him. Ahmadinejad went missing for a couple weeks, missed cabinet meetings, other things, came back now. But we have to remember, and this is something that never gets mentioned, remember that the leaders of the opposition, Mousavi, Karoubi, all these guys, you don't hear them. They've been missing since they were taken away many, many months ago. Where's the outcry? Where's anybody talking about what's happening to them?
They're sitting in the Iranian Siberia.
They're in detention in some place, right, exactly. And they get completely forgotten.
I got to run way behind.
Wait, we have to say the good news, that the Israeli population reached 7,746,000. It's like your marathon. Bells going off.
The numbers keep going up.
Thank God the numbers go up.
Main event caterer's calculator.
75% are Jewish, 20.5% are Arab, and 70% or more of the population are native-born Israelis.
I got to say one other thing, and you could use this in your Amunah speech on Sunday if you want.
God willing. In honor of Mindy Stein.
Could you imagine a typical Jew in Europe in 1940, if you would have said to them, in less than 10 years, there will be, under Jewish sovereignty, a state of Israel that has already, right, by 1950, you could say, has already begun to flourish and be a player in the world and be a safe haven for Jews and continue to advance in every area imaginable, an absolute nirvana for the Jewish people.
And be a startup nation.
Could you imagine saying that to a Jew in 1950?
Jerusalem under Jewish control united and Harabait under Jewish sovereignty.
Well, that's 1967. But could you imagine saying that in 1940 to a typical European Jew suffering through what they suffered through, that in less than 10 years that would be the case?
I have to tell you, I thought of things not quite like that when we were in Auschwitz and Birkenau last week. And when you see the kids marching with Israeli flags and you see some Israeli soldiers and others coming through, it's exactly what you think about. And for those who demean it, and some of the things that we heard over the last week during Yom HaTzmaut about some of the reactions and stuff, I think people better do a lot of rethinking.
No question about it. Future of the Jewish peoples in the State of Israel. Thank you, Malcolm. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Good luck Sunday, and we'll speak next week. 25 minutes after 8 o'clock. My gosh, behind schedule, but we had a lot to talk about on this weekly update.